about not being. This is Gloria Schwartz from the Gratz College Oral History Archive interviewing John Sauber on October 21st, 1999. John, yes, you were telling me about your experience with this group.
I was asked to do this interview a few years ago, which I wasn't able to do because in my thoughts, I wasn't just ready to talk about what I went through. I didn't even speak to my children, which are now I know that I should have told them about me, but I just didn't have the strength. My problem wasn't really myself, what I went through. My problem is coping with the loss of my family. And to this day, although I took this course, we got a landmark forum, and we talked about our past, and we had to literally lie on the floor and cry about these things to get it out of our system. And since then, I was really able to talk about my experiences. But again, until that time, and even today, the loss of my family was my biggest problem, so to speak. For what I was going through in camps, and I saw how these people were treated when they came off the boxcars and lined up and separated, and those little babies, and even grown-up women and mothers cried as they were separated, because they usually separated the old from the young, the one who were able to work. And I often thought when I saw this, did my mother and sister went through these things? Were they lined up and beaten? Did they go into a shower and never came out alive? Or they just died because of the sicknesses during the transportation in those boxcars? And this was on my mind for many months and years. And when I woke up in the middle of the night, I was thinking about this thing. Did they really suffer like that? And I was hoping that if they did die, it was fast and they didn't have to suffer. When I came home from the camps, some of the ladies that survived in the building where my mother and my sister was taken from, what they was telling me that my mother really didn't have to go because she was older, she was in a different age group. But my sister, who was 19 years at the time, my mother didn't want to leave her alone. We were a very close knit family before the war, and we grew up very close to each other. And for a time after, I blamed my mother too for leaving me, and she died, but she didn't have to. But then somebody told me that if a boat sinks in the middle of the lake, and he's got the son and the daughter, and she got the son and the daughter with her, which one would she save first? So I couldn't live with these thoughts for a long time. And as I told you just now, I'm able to talk about these things. I was 17 years old. I was just graduated in the spring of 1944, actually a couple of months earlier because of the war. And I remember with my yellow star, I had to go and do these tests before the graduation papers and all that. And soon after this, I was drafted into what they call the forced labor units. We were put in boxcars and taken all the way almost to the Russian front. And it didn't make sense because the Russians were coming, advancing already. They were in Romania, and half the Poland was liberated already, and they were coming, and they still, the killing and the deporting went on. And this train, we were going towards the front with this forced labor unit. It could go only so far because you could see the guns going up in the far hills. And we had to get off this train and carry our shovels and our picks, and we marched about 2 days without stopping, no food, no nothing. And the guards were on the wagons pulled by the horses, and we had to march and run after them, and we couldn't stop for 2 solid days. We finally got there, but the Russians were just the other side of the hill. And I was wounded. I got a huge piece of shrapnel in my back. And as the Germans were retreating, they pushed me on one of these flatbed trucks and took me with them to a hospital. They didn't have time, so they gave me a piece of wet cloth to put at them on my back and tried to wipe off the blood, whatever. And maybe 3 or 4 days after, I was put on a Red Cross train with all the wounded soldiers, the Germans and Hungarian soldiers and some Romanians. And we traveled about 2 days, and that train had to stop too, I guess for some reason. There was the troop movements. And when they discovered that I was Jewish, I had no business being on a German Red Cross train. And by convenience, there was another train on the next track in boxcars full of Jews that was shoved right in there. And that was my first experience with people. These people were on the train for 9 days without food, half dead on the floor, excrements, vomits, a couple of babies lying on their dead mothers, tugging on their hair, yelling, "Mother." I was 17 and a half years. I have never left home, so I didn't know things like this existed. I was on the train for another 8 days before we got to Germany. We arrived late afternoon. It was almost evening because it started to get dark. Whoever was able fell out of the boxcars, and we were lined up. And I guess I could still walk and raise my hand because I was selected with probably another 20 or 22 people who could move to sweep up the boxcars, to pull out the dead bodies and sort of clean up. And then we were herded into the camps and lined up, and they took our names, and we had to get into these huge blocks. And when I walked into one of these blocks, they were, oh, I don't know, about 200 feet long. And it was a narrow corridor in the middle. And on each side, there were 2 or 3 rows of these wooden planks, and people were hanging out. And they were just bones, skin and bones. And I said, "Oh my God." And at the end of the block, there was 2 younger boys around my age, and they were motioning for me to come to their, where they were sleeping on the second level on the wooden planks. And I found out later they were Polish boys. I was Hungarian. At home we never spoke Jewish, so I couldn't really converse with them at first. I quickly learned their language because we kept together for a few months. But one of the other boys got very sick though lately. And I used to help him. I did some odd jobs at the kitchen. I used to cut the hairs off from the dead bodies because the Germans, for some reason, they were collecting the hairs. I had to remove from the oven some of the gold teeth that was left behind. Someday they gave me a wheelbarrow to put some of the bones and bodies. And the ones that didn't die in the ovens, I had to pile them like pieces of wood on the ground. And on my way home from the kitchen, I used to pick up the peelings from the potatoes and used to feed this sick boy with that so he can get some strength. We didn't get bread anymore because I guess they were very short.
What camp was this?
Bergen Belsen. And when we finally got a piece of bread, I saw a father and son fighting over a little piece that one half was cut a little bigger than the father's. I saw some of the boys, a 20 or 22 year old boy, woke up in the morning and I told him, what happened to your hair? But one half of his hair was solid white overnight. We kept together, we have three of us, so finally learned some of the language, Yiddish and Polish, and we constantly tried to cover up for this boy. By then it was winter, and I remember pulling off some of the jackets or these shirts from the dead body so I wouldn't be cold. And I finally got one shoe, but I couldn't find the other one, so I had one shoe on my foot. And I really don't know how we survived that winter. We had to stand for count. And I remember this other boy, this friend of mine, he was Tweel, I forgot his name already. When they started to count, he would sort of run to the other end of the line, so he'd be counted again. But this boy was so sick he couldn't come out for the count, so he would stay inside. Sleeping on the top level, I used to put my hand out and scrape some of the tar off from the roof and smear it on my body so the lice wouldn't be, because everybody was full of lice. And that was very hard. But when I was liberated, I went home. I was the first one to come home. There was nobody home. Every morning went to the synagogue that listed the people who were discovered they were still alive and looking for it. One day I discovered my father's name. And he was in the same camp I was, but we never met.
Was this Bergen-Belsen?
Bergen-Belsen, yeah. But ironically, a very good friend of mine, we grew up together and we graduated together. We went through the front, the Russian front business together. His father was in Bergen-Belsen too, and they met, my father and his father met, and that was something really unbelievable. The camp was, I have really no words for that. I've seen people for no reason kicked and shoved over and just killed without anything. They couldn't get up. They told him to get up. He couldn't get up. He was beaten to death or killed to death. It's been such a long time that really certain details that would tie into each other, I just can't. It's some dramatic things are in my mind, I can tell you. I arrived at camp in early September 1944. And when I was liberated in this American or English hospital, I think it was Hillersleben, the town called, they weighed me in. I think it must have been an old school. They just suddenly just converted into a hospital or a treatment center, whatever you call it. They weighed me in, I don't know, in pounds. I guess it would be about 70 pounds, but about 35 kilos or 36 kilos I would weigh. But in the last 2 days or 3 days before we were liberated, the Germans were acting funny. We didn't know. We had no news of nothing. We heard the bombings going on, the Americans coming at night, I guess, and the British during the day. But we know there was something going on. And the day before, the Allied troops got there, the Germans were gone. By midnight, the lights weren't on anymore, the guards were gone, and the people started to leave the barracks, and they broke open the magazines, and I've seen people just eating half a bread. They just stuffed it in, and their stomach blew up, and they were told not to eat just a little bit, but they couldn't. They were so hungry. I mean, you couldn't help it. And the next morning, I went out too, and I saw a soldier, must have been a British soldier or some Allied soldier at the gates, and I know that was the end of it. So I ran back, and I got my two pals. I told them, they're here. Come and see them. They're at the gates. They're coming in. And the other fellow jumps on, but the one fellow that was sick, he couldn't come off. So I said, you have to come and see. But he said, I can't move. I can't. So we went, we pulled them off the gate from the bed, and we hold them sort of one on one side, and I'm on the other side, and sort of dragging him. There's about quite a walk, a few hundred feet, I would say, to them. And we were dragging him. Getting heavier and heavier. And by the time we got to the gate, he died in our hands. That was one of the very first moment in my life, at least up to that time. Because during that few months we grew together, we were almost like one. We never fought. If one had something to share, food or whatever, a piece of cloth, we shared it all. And that was the first time an experience that death was really terrible, if you lose someone that you love. I think I have to stop for a minute.
Mr. Sauber, I'd like to ask you some questions about your family in Hungary. Could you tell me where you were born and when?
I was born August the 14, 1926, in Budapest.
And can you tell me a little bit about your family?
I had a sister who was 2 years and 11 days older than I was. Mm-hmm. Yeah. My mother and her sister married my father's brother. In other words, two brothers married mm-hmm. two sisters. And for that reason alone, the two families are very, very close-knit. My uncle and my aunt had one boy, one son, who was a year younger than I was, but he was really like a brother to me. and we grew up together until we were 6 years old in Budapest. At that time, my father and my uncle, they built a house about 20 or 25 miles just out of Budapest. And I guess for our children's sake, so we could be in a, we could be closer in a more quiet atmosphere than in Budapest. They were working very hard, my parents, and so were my cousin's parents. My mother had a store where she had to go to the market maybe 4:30 in the morning when the farmers brought in their fruits and vegetables and geese and chicken. And my mother had to do the shopping very early, so I didn't see her in the mornings. My father worked for a shoe store chain, the big chain, actually of German chain, the Salamander. They're very famous in Europe. And also my father also left very early, so our, as children we were left on our own, and we walked to the school every morning with my sister, and my cousin went to the same school. And we lived in that house until I finished public school when I was 10 years old. And then we had to move back to Budapest. I went to high school, and there was no high school in that little village or
what was town. The name of that village?
In Hungarian.
Okay.
It's spelled Rakos. KERESZTUR.
Thank you.
And then we moved back to Budapest, and by then my mother tried to get me into these high schools. That's what they call a numerus clausus. There are only so many Jews who were accepted into classes. Finally, we found this school, and I was registered in that school. That was an 8-year course, and after you finished that and graduated, you were able to go to university, right into law or medicine, whatever, which I did go after the war when I came in. I had 3 semesters of medical schooling before I left Hungary after the war. But going back to our family, parents worked very hard, 6 days a week. But Sunday, we went on picnics. Budapest was in two parts, what they call a Buda and a Pest. And one side is, the Pest side is where most of the people live. On the other side, crossing the Danube, the bridges, the better class of people lived. And they were surrounded by all these mountains, which was visible from any part of the country. And that's where we used to go on Sundays, to go on these mountains with my cousin and, of course, their family. And those were the very good times. Until, say, 1943 or 1942, when the Germans started to more pressure on the Hungarian government. And living in Budapest, in a way we were lucky because Budapest was the last place where they deported the Jews. They were all taken from the smaller towns and cities, northern part of Hungary. They were very thickly populated by Jewish people. And life really began with hardships as far as food. Everything was rationed already. After a while, Jews only got half the ration cards. I remember lining up for bread. By the time I got there, they were all gone because first the full card, which had a different color, they were in first in line, and Jews were in the back, and by the time many times I got there was no bread left. But my mother, knowing these people before from the country, used to buy the produce and the fruit smoke. They were always bringing up some flours and sugar and whatever we needed for cooking.
These were non-Jewish Hungarians?
Yes, they were farmers living in outside in the country. We were religious, if you like. We had separate dishes for milk system Fleischigs. And I remember my dad always, before Yom Kippur, prayed with these chickens over our heads, and he would throw away the chicken, meaning, I guess, symbolizing throw away the sins or whatever was explained to me. And then we had to start wearing yellow stars, all the Jews. Mm-hmm. And we were afraid to go on the street because there was a lot of beating and killing.
When did you have to wear the yellow stars? What year was that?
I think it started early 1944, if my memory is correct. When I graduated, probably a week after, then we had to report for this hard labor service. Because I was in a certain age group, and we had to report.
Can you tell me what the relations were like with the other Hungarian students in your classes?
In my class, there were 36 students at the time. And there were about 10 or 11 Jewish students. Usually it's only 3 or 4 Jewish students in a class, but because some of the school did not accept Jews, and this school tolerated more Jews than any other school, so we had more Jews in the class. And so the third of the class were Jewish boys. Of course, we were very close. Once a week we had to go early Friday afternoon for service from school. That was compulsory. And we went to this synagogue in Budapest, one of the famous, one of the biggest in Hungary, which was renovated now. When I went back, I saw it was beautifully renovated. We had to go there every Friday.
What was the name of that synagogue?
Dohány Temple. Mm-hmm. It's spelled Dohány.
You were saying that you on Friday afternoons the Jewish students went to the Dohány Synagogue.
Yeah, it was compulsory. It was part of our education. We had the religious instructions twice a week in class. The Jewish students went to another class, the Catholics stayed, and the Protestant or other religions went to another class. In my class, I would say that maybe 2 or 3 students that were part of the Hungarian Arrow Party, which were the Nazis. And I have some Christian friends, very good friends to date. As a matter of fact, if I could tell you a story about this boy, his parents were not getting along, so to speak, at the time. And this fellow was very distraught. So I walked him home, excuse me, it was a Saturday afternoon, and he was ready to kill himself because of his parents. And anyway, I talked to him, and I told him, if you don't want to stay home, come with me. He came to my place, and my mother fed him, and he stayed a day or two for the weekend. Anyway, to make the story short, he became a gynecologist. And when I went back to my 50th reunion 5 years ago, class reunion, he was there. He was retired already. And I never forget this, too. He came to me, looked in my eyes, and he gave me a hug, and he said, "I wish for you what I wish for myself." And he was Christian, and he had a very good relationship with him after that. And I also had another friend. He wasn't Jewish, but we lived in the same block, so we used to walk home from school with him. The teachers were democratic, if you like. I couldn't find any discrimination in class between Jews and Catholics. The only time I found discrimination when I had to go to write tests to graduate. The way it was done with other professors and teachers, not by your own teacher. They come from another school, and they give you a question, and that was it. If you didn't know the answer to that, you failed. And there I noticed some discriminations. And there I noticed when they picked the questions that I was one of the Jews in the sixth. They went by initials of M, J, whatever. And there were six of us there. I was the only Jew. And the questions they were asking there, they had the questions pre-written, what they're going to ask. And they were some of those questions were really, I could have answered when I was 7 years old, and they weren't given to me. I had the most difficult questions because I sit there with my yellow stars. And that was the only time I really experienced anti-Semitism into life against students. But in my regular class, all my teachers, and everyone was a different for geology, geographic, and there was another teacher, but math teacher, and history teacher, physics teacher. We had all five or six different teachers. None of them, I think, were anti-Semitic.
How about the two students who belonged to the Arrow Cross?
Ironically, one survived and was at the 50th reunion, and he apologized. There was two Jewish, myself and another friend, to survive. All the rest of the Jews, I don't know what happened to them, either they died or whatever. Anyway, he came over, he says, "I know at that time it was wrong," and he apologized to me for that. Even though I had no experience anything with him at that time, if he was deaf, he stood up on the top of the table and said that the Germans will this and this and that, and will get rid of these people that don't belong in this country. You know, I had personally had no problems with him, but we knew, or the Jews knew, that he was there. So I guess the other one, I don't know what happened. But he was the only Arrow Cross that survived. My parents were worried in the last few weeks before it really happened. I remember going to this lawyer, tried to explore the possibilities to immigrate to another country. And we started the papers, and it was very slow and slow, and by the time the Germans got there, it was too late already, so we just couldn't get out of the country.
I'd like to ask you, did you belong to any youth groups, Jewish youth groups? Were there any in Budapest that you
yes,
were aware of?
Each school, like this high school that we did, have the Boy Scouts. So I belonged to the high school Boy Scout unit. But as the Jewish laws came in one by one, Jews couldn't have radios. And as a Boy Scout, we had to go with these cars and collect, as a Jewish Boy Scout, collect the radios and the mortar and pestles that were made out of copper and stuff for the war effort. But after a while, there's another law came out that Jewish Boy Scouts don't belong to regular Boy Scout units. So we had to go and join a Jewish Boy Scout unit. They were still operating. So I joined the Jewish Boy Scout unit. I also played the violin, studied violin for 6 years. And I went to the Budapest Academy of Music, I think that's a proper translation. But after the fifth or the 6 years, I couldn't go anymore because I was Jewish. They didn't accept me for finishing my school there.
Were there Zionist youth groups that you were aware of?
They were a Zionist group, but they were under the table or behind closed doors. There was nothing really open. But going back to the synagogue that we used to go every Friday, there was one Friday night, I'm not sure, or Saturday morning service, when the Jews were coming out of the synagogue, someone from across the building, from the rooftop, they threw a grenade on the steps, and I think 5 or 6 Jewish people were killed. And that was in the paper, but after that was it. There was no investigation, or nobody knew who did it, or didn't care, whatever. But I remember going by the synagogue and looking at the stairs. There was about 6 stairs going up to the synagogue, and I saw the dent of this bomb, whatever caused. And when I went back after 50 years, the synagogue was beautifully remodeled, and I looked at the stairs, of course it was beautiful again.
Culturally, did your family feel close to the Hungarians, you know, as a culture?
Yes, in Budapest, most Jews, or the great number of Jews, and I think there were almost 100,000, if not over 100,000 Jews in Budapest, and all Budapest was only over 1 million people. And we had what you might call a ghetto. Just behind this big synagogue, there was 3 or 4 streets that were very religious Jews lived. But the Jews lived outside of this area, what you call a Jewish area or ghetto. They were assimilated, so to speak, not really by choice, because that was the only way to get a job, to exist, to you wouldn't have to be afraid to walk on the street because there were might be beatings in the area where the Jews lived. And yes, there were some Christian people, they were friends, you were friendly with. We were friendly with this couple. The lady was Jewish and the husband was Christian. And they were also a very good friend of ours. And it came the time when Jewish people couldn't have businesses. And my mother had to get out of the business. We had a couple of ladies, I don't know where they got it, some Christian ladies. They came into the business as partners on their name. But as the Germans and the Hungarian arrow cross got stronger and stronger, these two Christian ladies, actually they kicked my mother out of the store. And they told them, this is not your store anymore. And that was the end of that.
What languages did your parents speak?
The Hungarian. Only. My mother was born in Budapest. My father was born in a Romanian part of Hungary that was lost to the Romanians after the First World War. And my grandfather spoke and my grandmother spoke Yiddish at home while they were living there, what they call Oradea Mare, or Nagyvárad was the name of the place, the city. So my father knew a few Jewish words, but he couldn't use it because my mother didn't know any Yiddish. So at home we talked Hungarian, strictly Hungarian. But I learned quickly in camps because I couldn't get along with my Hungarian. It was Jews from all over the country there, from Europe really. And I learned a few Yiddish words there.
Had your family experienced any pogroms in Hungary?
Any?
Pogroms?
No, not until the last few weeks, I would say. When I wasn't home, just what I heard. Mm. My cousin, whom I told you I grew up with just like my brother, I was told that he was caught by this arrow cross on the streets. And in those days it was very fashionable to hang Jews on a lamppost in the corner on the streets. And they told me that he was working for the Zionist underground or with this Hanna Senesh. Mm-hmm. He was in that group and he was caught and my cousin was hung up on the street to hang him.
What was your cousin's name?
His name was Gyula, or Julius, if you like, if you want to translate it. And I was really called George at home, or Judy.
Did your father serve in World War I?
Yes, my father was in World War I. He was on the Italian front. He was also wounded. He showed me his hands. He had some scars. Talking about wounded, and my wound in my back, I still have the shrapnel. It was never taken out because they didn't have time for Jews to operate on. And I still have the piece on my left shoulder. Ironically, I didn't have, I don't know what you call it, I just couldn't fill out applications when I came to Canada for restitution. And by the time I applied, it was too late. Then I tried a lawyer from New York, and I paid a few $100 for him. He's going to do it. And I gave him the money, and I filled out the papers. I have never heard from him since. So I just given up. I know my father got restitutions while he was living in Hungary after the war.
Yeah.
And if I just may finish this little story while it's in my head. My father got married, remarried, a very nice lady in Budapest. I spent 2 years after the war in Germany waiting to come to America or Canada or go to Israel. But in those days it was Palestine. My father got married in Budapest again. And when I came to Canada, after a few years, soon I had some money, I brought him out. And so I looked after my father and my stepmother. My father passed away a few years ago. And my stepmother passed away just this summer. She was 94 years old. And that's another milestone in my life. She loved me dearly, I'm sure. She never had any children of her own. Her husband, first husband, also died in the camps. But when she died, and we buried him, see, I never had a... I'm sorry.
Shall I turn it off?
That's okay. I never really had a chance to say Kaddish for my mother. So when I stood up in the synagogue to say Kaddish for my stepmother, I remember looking at one of the windows with the color glass, and it looked like the menorah, and I saw my mother's face as I said the Kaddish, and I said another one right after. I said, don't have to. Yes, I do. I want to say one for my sister, and I said the third one for my cousin, who was really my brother. And I think that was the first time, strangely, because I buried my stepmother, that I really felt that I buried my mother at the same time, in peace. Because when I recall when I came home after the war, I wouldn't want to believe that my mother was gone and my sister was gone. I always looked at pictures of these camps. I was searching for, maybe she's one of them, but of course it wasn't. I just thought I'd tell you that this also, it was a feeling that I really buried my mother in peace. I said to Kaddish. So you see, it really wasn't me that I was recalling my experiences in the 50 years. It really didn't matter. What I was recalling is the memories, the way I saw my mother when I last saw her. And those were the important things to me. And maybe that's why I couldn't talk to my children, tell me about my experiences, but it wasn't important to me. Physically, I was strong enough to survive. But inside of me is very soft, and that's what it hurts inside. But I'm getting on with years already. I'm 73 years old, and the wounds heal slowly, I guess. And everything comes to an end, suffering as well as happiness and everything.
The situation in Hungary when the Germans took over the government, the Nazi elements, was your family, were you aware of what was happening with the Jewish Council, with any negotiations with the Germans?
No. No, we didn't know.
You mentioned Hannes Enish.
Yeah.
What other elements of the Zionist efforts were you aware of, or is this something you learned about afterward?
Well, Hannes Enish, I learned afterwards. There were very small groups. For very good reason, they didn't want to bunch up together because the more people, there was more visibility, so to speak. So we stayed in small groups. The 12 students, Jewish students in my class, because I played the violin, one played the piano, one of the saxophone, we get together and get these musical sort of get-togethers. But actually what we talked really was politics. And one of the boys was connected to another group, and that's where we got our news from, through this fella. And we got to, but if you had more than 20 or 25 or 15 Jews together, that was already suspicious, and was no way we could do that.
Do you know the name of the group that this fellow was connected with?
This was a Zionist group that was organizing to go to Palestine. That's all I know. And what he was saying, that this group formed a kibbutz, and they were looking for tailors and shoemakers and bakers, and someday or soon, whenever the chance comes, they were going to go to Palestine. And it looked funny at that time, because in one hand, in this little room, but I don't know how many people, maybe a dozen people planning for the future, and then we stepped outside and we were worried at the present time. Maybe tomorrow we won't be able to step outside already. So it was an ironic situation. As far as I know, in our family, or my father, or my mother, or our parents, or our, they never talked anything about organized groups, Jewish groups. So we had no knowledge of these until after the war. But as I said before, I was told that my cousin was working for one of these big groups.
Did you have any knowledge or hear anything about Wallenberg, a man who was helping Jews with visas?
Yes. Yes. When I was transferred from that German Red Cross hospital train into these wagons, these people in the boxcars, they come from Budapest. And in that car I overheard this family, the whole family, with a father and a mother and two daughters, I think, when I got on in the boxcar. And they were on that boxcar, as I told you, 8 or 9 days already. And this family was, and I heard them, overheard them to talk, that the father was talking to the girls or the mother, I don't know to whom, but he says, you know, if we weren't, all we needed one more day, because groups were going to this consulate, the Swedish consulate, and they were issued these passport, Swedish passport, which weren't recognized after a while anyway. So the father said to his mother, all we needed two more days, and this, we could have gotten this passport from the Swedish consul, Wallenberg.
Okay.
That's what the only time I heard there was something going on, you know, while I was away. Yeah.
Were you aware of any Jews trying to escape? Did anyone in your family or any friends try to escape from Hungary to avoid the deportation?
I had one friend, but not from Budapest, but familiar in this group in Romania on the front working. He tried to escape, and he was about my age. And he was a very intelligent boy. I would say he was a scholar. And he was caught. And he was sent back to us. And he couldn't talk anymore. And he was like a vegetable. And what came out is one of these guards came out. If you want to escape, you will end up exactly like him. And what they did, they had him go down on his knees or his, on his ankles, to sit on his ankle and hold his gun all night in his hand. Then they shaved his head and they beat him. Anyway, when he came back to the group, he didn't talk for days. He was just like a vegetable. He just moved, and what they did to that fellow, they really destroyed him. So after that, none of us really was thinking of escaping. From other parts of the country, yes, if you had money, I found that out later, after the war, that you could pay off even the Germans. And there were incidents that I don't know what they did, fly him out or transport him into Switzerland for millions and millions of dollars. But you had lots of money. Germans did that too. Not too often, I guess. But we as a family, we didn't hear anything going on like that.
I'd like to ask you about the transport. When you were wounded and put on the transport, where was that transport going? What camp did you all go to at that time?
Well, the Red Cross train?
I believe you said that you were taken off of the Red Cross train and put on the boxcars.
Yeah.
And that's where the Jews from Budapest were in that car with you.
Well, the Red Cross train was heading from where I was put on, just the outside of the Hungarian border in Romania. And they were, because a lot of German and Hungarian, the Hungarians and the German, they were packing up in Budapest and going to Germany too. So the Red Cross train was heading to Germany.
Okay.
And I think that the Hungarian town's name was Esztergom when they stopped. And that's where we met this other train coming from Budapest with the Jewish people in the boxcars.
And that train, you were put on that deportation train?
Yes.
Where did that train go?
We went through Austria, we went through, we didn't know, we were traveling 3 or 4 days, but I could see some signs.
I'm actually wondering what camp, what was the destination as far
Bergen-Belsen. Bergen-Belsen. See, that was almost to the last part. That was in September already. September 1944. And I think Budapest was liberated January 1st or 2nd week of January, I was told. So most of the Jews, and I met another Jewish man in Toronto who was also taken to Bergen-Belsen from Budapest. He might have been on that train, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But those were the last of the people. That's why a lot of those people had a chance to survive. Because these two boys that I was in with, these two Polish boys, they were there for 3.5 years in that camp. Before I got in, I was only there from September to mid-April, I think, when we were liberated. That's only 8 or 9 months. So that's why I guess one of the things, one of the reasons I was able to survive. Again, I don't know physically how I've done it. You know, there's a little wind. I am cold already there. I had a little shirt and nothing practically in the winter time, standing in line. And so the train was going to Bergen-Belsen.
Were you aware at the time that there were trains from Hungary going to Auschwitz?
No. No, we didn't know. Nobody knew, really. All we knew that they told us, because we, this young men and young women, were going to work camps, going to work because we do. And ironically, I thought of this many times, that when I was taken away into these forced labor camps, I was wondering if the Hungarian government, there were some elements in the Hungarian government that they weren't sympathetic to the Germans. They created these groups so that to save these boys, to send them out of harm's way. I may be wrong, but at the time, when we formed this brigade, this working brigade, and we sent it out to work. Well, we worked. We did hard work. We built railroads, and we worked like dogs for no pay, of course. So we were lucky if we got some food. But we were sort of out of harm's way, if you like, because if you stayed behind, like my father, because he was older, so he was taken to the concentration camp. Mm-hmm. He would have been younger. Maybe he went to a workforce somewhere in, like I did. Maybe he would have survived too. But we had no idea what was going on.
Was your father taken to Auschwitz?
No, he was taken to Bergen-Belsen.
Yeah, so.
He was in the same camp I was, but I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And because he was selling shoes and he knew all about shoes, he worked in a shoe as a repairman. I don't know. He never repaired shoes, but he became a shoe repairman in the camps, repairing German boots. I heard when he came over. But it was a huge camp. It was two sides of this camp. We had an old and a new side. I guess there were so many people there. And we never met in a camp. Never. We were there.
Can you tell me about the liberation? What happened once the camp was liberated? Where were you taken?
Well, first we're taken to this place. If I remember correctly, it was Hillersleben. I told you, but that was the name of the place. And this was probably a school or another public building made into a first aid or whatever. And they gave us soup first because they didn't want us to get sick. They fed us slowly.
Yeah.
And after that, we were set free, so it's free to go. I stayed there maybe 4 or 5 days in this hospital, if you want to call it. And after that, we had to go and register. They took our x-rays, you know, the UNRRA. The UNRRA was there, UNRRA.
Oh, right.
It's called.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to get home. So I... I went to the highway, and the Russians were coming too, and they were going back, because this wasn't a Russian zone, I guess. But I was walking. And after a day or two walk, I saw a Russian coming with a horse and buggy, and it's carrying something all piled up. So I hitchhiked, so he took me on. And